This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Shahid Abdullah and you are listening to The Breakfast Grill. Advancing technology has disrupted the industries that we used to know. In recent years, we saw your Grab driver disrupted the taxi driver. But what if one day autonomous self-driving cars would instead disrupt them? So my guest this morning is Dr. Carl Benedict Frey, an economist, as well as the author of The Technology Trap, Capital, Labor and Power in the Age of Automation. He will be speaking to us about how exposed our current jobs are to automation in the future. Dr. Carl, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
My pleasure.
So the premise of your book is basically on how the Industrial Revolution changed the world, particularly in relations to jobs and income. Now, can you quickly give us a little background as to why you chose this topic and why is it relevant to us today?
Sure. So a couple of years ago, Michael Osborne and I published a study in which we estimated roughly 47% of American jobs are at risk of being automated due to advances in mobile robotics and artificial intelligence. And the question that we've gotten often since then has been, is this time different somehow? Because we have arguably been through periods of rapid technological change before. And I think it's somewhat mistaken to sort of lump together the past as one, because we've been through very different periods of technological change in the past. And what I argue in the book is that this time so far has been most similar to the first Industrial Revolution, which took off in Britain around 1760, and led to sort of very similar economic trends that we see in recent decades. So back then, we saw hollowing out of middle-income jobs. We saw wages falling behind productivity growth or output growth, which is just a different way of saying that labor share of income fell. The wages were stagnant. Productivity growth was slow to take off in the early days. Also, we saw a lot of political and social unrest, and you know, the wages of those at the lower end of the income distribution actually fell and remained flat for roughly seven decades. And a key puzzle to economic historians has been that why would people have voluntarily agreed to participate in the industrialization process if it reduced their utility? And the simple answer is that they didn't. They rioted against the mechanized factor on several occasions. Most people are familiar with the Luddite riots, but they were only part of a long wave of riots that swept across Britain and even Europe. In addition to that, workers petitioned to Parliament to have them sort of blocking the introduction of new technologies. The key point is that a lot of these revolutionary technologies led to political revolutionaries as well. And that is to some extent similar to what we're seeing today, because we've seen very much this polarization of the economic social fabric as a result of manufacturing jobs being automated away. But we haven't seen outright assistance to mechanization, at least yet. But I don't think that's something that we can take for granted. So a recent Pew Research survey suggests that roughly 85% of Americans now favor policies to introduce legislation to block the rise of the robots, if you like. For most of history, resistance to technological progress has been the norm rather than the exception. So if technological progress was not something natural, we would have invented the Industrial Revolution a bit earlier in the history of mankind rather than 200 years ago.
Okay, so Dr. Carl, after reading your book, considering the current policies that most countries have today, is it really all that doom and gloom based on all the issues that you have outlined are not addressed carefully?
No, I mean, the long-run story of technological progress has been the quite opposite to doom and gloom, right? So in the industrial West, not so long ago, a lot of people worked in coal mines. Cave-ins and explosions were part of everyday working life. And lung disease is often part of the work package today in the West. Most people work in air-conditioned offices. People today are roughly 40 times richer adjusted for inflation, and that, if anything, understates the transformation that has taken place, because people have access to so many goods that were inconceivable even back then, like antibiotics, automobiles, lots of electrical appliances and so on. So the long-run story has been fantastic. The short-run, during the first industrial revolution in particular, was devastating to large part of the population. And more recently, what we've seen is that especially prime-age men without a high school degree would have flocked into the factories before the age of automation. Their wages in the US have actually been falling for consecutive decades now. So they've been net losers to automation in the labor market. So I don't think that there is anything inevitable, but I do think that people have a rational reason to opt against automation if they don't see the benefits from it. Sure, you can say that, well, maybe the next generation will be better off as a result of the pains, transitional pains, the current generation goes through. But still, there's no way of knowing that either. And I'm not quite convinced most people buy into that sort of argument. Overall, I think we need to manage transition to be sure that the benefits are being more widely shared, and there's no outright resistance to mechanization.
So, I mean, my take with regards to some of the things I picked up when I read your book is that it seems difficult to stop the wave of automation, and as a result of countries facing the dilemma of actually balancing economic growth as well as at the same time ensuring labor is employed. Now, is there any way capital as well as labor substitution can coexist meaningfully in this sort of brave new world?
Absolutely. I mean, it's done so for 200 years. I think it's a matter of going through a period of adjustment. Often you see that particularly older workers lose out from this, and you need to make sure that you help people. So you need to think about things like relocation vouchers, because often new jobs don't emerge in the same place as the old ones are being destroyed, and people need to be able to adjust to that. Moving can be seen as an investment, which requires liquidity up front in order to get a return later on. And there's a case for potentially subsidizing that and help people move. You can think about wage insurance for people that shift down from middle-income jobs to low-income jobs, and the government tops up their incomes. But I think that also a lot can be achieved through investment in infrastructure and housing. So where I grew up, for example, in southern Sweden, Malmö, city that was doing poorly for a long time economically, and with the bridge to Copenhagen, people could live in Malmö where housing was cheap, commuting to Copenhagen where it was better paid jobs. Most of them would spend their money locally, which gave a boost to the local service economy in Malmö and created the virtuous cycle, and it's now one of the most dynamic labor markets in Europe. So I think a lot depends actually on policy and connecting expanding and declining regions and so on. So yes, I think that can be achieved.
How would you sum up our achievement during this period, if you consider those who were left behind as a result of the revolution?
Yeah, I mean, during the first industrial revolution, obviously, people still believed that the world was Malthusian. So they thought that, higher incomes will only translate into larger populations. So there will be no income gains in per capita terms. And as a result of that, people also thought that redistributing income was essentially meaningless, because there was nothing that could be done in helping the poor. And that led to the poor laws being repealed in 1834. And essentially the social net that existed being dismantled. And this time around, obviously, we know that we can do something to compensate losers. It's hard to compensate losers, that's true. We don't always know who they are, but the emergence of the welfare state of the 20th century at least allowed to alleviate some of the negative benefits on part of the workforce. And I think we can build on that. I think part of the problem now is not that people don't have sufficient consumption possibilities. I think most economists think of that the goal of production is consumption, but I don't think that's really true. I think people attach a lot of meaning to the work, and I think it's more about achieving a dynamic labor market where people lower skills also have opportunity.
In the meantime, I'm speaking to Dr. Carl Benedict Frey, an economist as well as the author of The Technology Trap, Capital, Labor and Power in the Age of Automation. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Carl on his view on whether education can save us from the impact of automation. So stay tuned on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
You are listening to BFM 89.9. On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Dr. Carl Benedict Frey, an economist as well as the author of The Technology Trap, Capital, Labor and Power in the Age of Automation. The government, it's all about politics. Now, there are always winners and losers in every scenario. At the end, whichever brings more votes, that's the policy direction that we will more likely to see. Now, how do we convince policymakers, you know, to care about the minority? In this instance, those who are displaced from their jobs, perhaps at the same time cushion the short-term impact of automation.
Well, the way we encourage policymakers is by demanding the right policies, but trying to be more long-termish ourselves in the way we vote and in the issues that we prioritize and care about. So I don't think that there's another way.
But do you think that that's possible today, especially what is the state of our union? Do you think that they're strong enough for us to voice out our objection when everything is moving fast?
Well, I think, I mean, it's easy to be gloomy and say that you know, everything is rigged, and that's essentially what the president of the United States claimed before he thought that he wasn't going to win, and he actually won. I think what the 2016 election in the United States show is that margins are very slim, and you know, a lot of people in the Rust Belt opted for Trump, and he became president as a result of that. Now, you know, we may not see that as positive change, but certainly it was change, and it wasn't in the interest of, you know, most larger corporations and so on. So I do think change is clearly possible. And I mean, it's important to remember that a lot of things that we take to granted in the West today, like democracy and, you know, rule of law and property rights and so on, were almost sort of as inconceivable at some point in time. So clearly, you know, this is possible change.
But on that subject, there's also that link, this movement, this populist nationalist sentiment, which has begun in the US and UK, in particular Brexit and the 2016 presidential election. Can we link that to purely the fear of globalization?
Yes, I think it's due to industrialization more broadly. So, if you go back and look at post-electoral service, and this is a work by Thomas Piketty, you see that in the 50s and 60s, the political right was primarily associated with high-income voters. The political left was primarily associated with low-income, low-skilled voters. From the 1780s onwards, that sort of shifts, and the political left becomes more associated with high education voters. And so since then, the sort of old working class, if you like, has become increasingly detached from mainstream political parties. That has happened during a period where economies have deindustrialized, where a lot of those people have been left worse off in the labor market. And I think what the populists are doing is that they are very effectively tapping into their anger. And this is something you can actually see in Sweden as well. So Torsten Persson and co-authors have a paper now that shows that the rise of the Swedish Democrats was at least in part due to job insecurity related to automation.
You highlighted in your book about the wage insurance. Now, is that your proposal when it comes to addressing job insecurities?
No, I don't think the wage insurance is the main proposal. I think there's a package of things that can make a big difference collectively that may seem sort of like a small policy intervention individually. But I think many different things together can make a big difference. So part of it would be relocation vouchers, which I mentioned earlier. to allow people to move. Part of it would be actually building more housing in prime locations where skilled jobs are emerging, because what we see is that, you know, technology industries, financial industry, creative industries, these are very clustered. When you create a new tech job in any given city, you create roughly 5 new jobs in the local service economy. That person goes out shopping, spends his or her money on, you know, grocery shopping, going to the hairdresser, taking a taxi, and so on and so forth. And that creates a lot of pressure on housing in those places where those new jobs are being emerging and being clustered. So I think we need to get rid of a lot of the hurdles to the supply of housing in those places, because one of the consequences of this has been that most of the gains from all of this have actually gone to owners of the real estate. And if you look at the work of Thomas Piketty, most of the upsurge in inequality is actually due to wealth inequality is actually due to housing. So I think we need to expand housing supply in those places. We need to connect declining and expanding places, and we need to make sure that, you know, people have the right skills. I mean, the way people have adjusted in the past is by acquiring new skills, moving into new jobs, and often to different places. And we need to support that and make that easier. But obviously, wage insurance can be part of that. But I think that's mainly for older workers, where, you know, retraining doesn't make much sense any longer.
Perhaps I could get your thoughts with regards to some of the big ideas that have been put on the table. For an example, universal basic income, as well as the UK Labour Party inclusive ownership funds. Are these proposals worth listening to, especially when it comes to addressing issues of job displacement?
Well, so I think if you go to universal basic income, first of all, I don't see why it should be universal. So, I mean, if you make it universal, essentially, it will just worsen inequality unless you raise taxes significantly, because you're going to redistribute transfers, which now target people on the bottom end of the income of the income distribution, to people at the middle of the sort of higher end of the income distribution. So I don't think that makes a great deal of sense. And I think in most European economies, at least, there's not room for that sort of a significant tax increase to introduce a universal basic income on top of everything else. So I think that's just impractical and undesirable. And I also think that, I mean, people's consumption possibilities in a way are better than they ever been. Like, true, there are some things that don't, get any cheaper, and that includes housing, education, healthcare. And I think we need to deal with those things more specifically rather than just redistributing income. And secondly, I think we need to realize that, you know, people derive a lot of meaning from their work. So we're making it too easy on ourselves if we think about this as just a redistributive challenge, because it's actually about providing jobs and opportunity, and that's what people care about and are concerned about.
Okay, so perhaps if you could just give us one more explanation with regards to wage insurance. How do you see this panning out? Has this idea gained any traction?
Well, wage insurance actually exists in the United States for workers that lose their jobs to Chinese import competition. They can claim some wage insurance. Now, it doesn't apply to other sources of dislocation like automation. And one proposal in the book is that should be expanded to include also other sources of dislocation. I think there are probably some reason to sort of have a closer look at also how it works in practice. I think it's been quite hard for people to prove that they lost their jobs to Chinese import competition in particular. So exactly sort of how the accountability part works is something that I think needs to be looked into. But it's not uncharted territory, so it's a proposal that is actually already in place.
We've been told that education could safeguard our future. Now, even if we do address this issue, which is bridging the education gap, can we see that number, that 47% of possible jobs that are going to be displaced, can that number be reduced as a result of bridging the education gap?
Right. So, I mean, first of all, 47% of jobs are not going to be replaced anytime soon. So, I mean, this is very much an estimate of what's technologically feasible. And, you know, over the long run, a lot of factors determine decisions to automate, right? So I think that there's still a lot of time for adjustments to be made. With regard to education, yes, as I mentioned earlier, the way people have adjusted in the past was by acquiring new skills. In the United States, you had the high school movement in the early 20th century, in which farmers essentially realized that for their children to prosper in the second industrial revolution, they need to have an education. And as a result of that, the high school movement started at the very bottom-upish movement and provided education that makes it made it easier for people to move into new occupations in, and industries. And I think something similar is needed today. I believe that, you know, we need to take much more modular approaches to education. So instead of having, you know, somebody studying at Oxford for 3 years you know, what they've learned over that period of time is essentially up to them, we should make sure that people can learn at their own pace. And, you know, if whether it takes you 6 months or 6 years to complete your degree, you should be able to do it in your own at your own pace. And I think that we need to learn also more in parallel to our jobs. And I think more modular approaches to education in particular would make that easier.
Has there been any examples of any education institution or any countries that has sort of implemented the modular approach?
It's, I mean, there are lots of individual examples, but there's nothing, as I'm aware of at least, that has got widespread use. So I think in Singapore, for example, they have this lifelong learning accounts now, which sort of aims at introducing people to the concept of lifelong learning. So you can get some credit to study whatever you want, whether it's film or whether it's physics. That's essentially just aims to introduce people to the concept. So I think it's early days, and you know, we need to evaluate some of these ideas at some point. But I think there's nothing that is really stuck yet.
Okay. One last question before we end our interview now. What is the or one idea that you want them to take away just from reading your book?
Well, I think people want to take away that technological progress is somewhat unnatural, right? People don't really like a lot of change, a lot of churn in the labor market. And the reason that we agreed to it is that with the belief that we will eventually come out ahead of, life will be better if we move between jobs and industries and so on. And I think that, you know, for people to not resist that unnatural tendency, they need to believe that they will eventually come out ahead. And if the wages don't rise for a long time, I think we need to step in and do something about it.
Dr. Carl, thank you so much for speaking to us on The Breakfast Grill this morning. I've been speaking to Dr. Carl Benedict Frey, an economist as well as the author of The Technology Trap, Capital, Labour and Power in the Age of Automation. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Sharitz Abdullah for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.